This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
I think TB is at a very interesting crossroads at the moment. The situation is still very bleak. It's the biggest infectious disease killer in the world. There are over 10 million people a year infected by TB and developing active disease, and almost 1.6 million people dying.
That's Willow Brock, Senior Vice President of the TB Alliance. We'll have full details on this story coming up.
Also, it may take 2 weeks to announce a winner in Cameroon's presidential election. And today, the WHO and officials in the DRC report a jump in the number of Ebola cases in the past few days.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroon's Election Commission says it may be 2 weeks away from announcing a winner in yesterday's presidential election. Today, however, opposition candidate Maurice Kamto declared himself the winner. That could put him in trouble with the law, as the Election Commission has said that any person who announces any election results before the Constitutional Court does will be committing an illegal act. Authorities in Cameroon have reported some voting irregularities and at least three deaths in Anglophone regions. Anglophone separatists want autonomous rule from the Yaoundé government. President Paul Biya has led Cameroon for 36 years and is expected to win another seven-year term. Bakassi Kora with VOA's French to Africa service is in Yaoundé to cover the election. Earlier today, he spoke with our colleague Kate Pound Dawson.
The capital here, Yaoundé, is really calm today. Life has started back up again because on Sunday there was a decree banning all traffic in the city. So it was quiet on Sunday. There was no movement in the city. But today it's bustling again. And we are right now, since the morning, at one of the candidates from the opposition. And in the neighborhood, everywhere, you can see police forces in riot gear everywhere. But the main information from yesterday is that Yaoundé was calm, everything went well. But in the Anglophone to Anglophone region that are experiencing issues of conflict and secessionism, there has been three people killed. It's information that VOA has been able to confirm with the army spokesperson. And so according to the information we are receiving from these two regions, the turnout has been very, very low because people, have been scared despite the heavy presence of security forces in this part of the country.
Right. So what is expected to happen next, or what's likely to happen in the coming days?
So yesterday, after the pool closed, we had a declaration from the director of the Electoral Commission, what is called ELECAM. He said everything went well, and he insisted, along with the Minister of Territorial Administration, at the same night yesterday, they all insisted that no one published the result before the Constitutional Court. And the Constitutional Court has until October 22nd to give a result. So they warn anyone who will proclaim any result or say that they won the election, they say the law will be applied to that person. We basically have a 2 weeks window where the result can be given any time by the Constitutional Court, but it can go up to October 22nd, as we said.
Have they given any indication that they might give the results sooner than that?
No, they didn't give any indication at all. And we don't expect to hear from the government today. Nothing has been announced. So maybe by the end of the day, we'll hear from some opposition leaders, because since yesterday, some have been complaining that the election was not going well, that members of their party have not been admitted in several polling places across the country. And also, I think in the Anglophone region of the opposition did not send a representative in most of the polling places.
Is this election expected to affect the tensions between the Anglophone region and the Francophone region, or will it change things at all?
It's possible because, you know, separatist movement, you know, went out yesterday trying to fire on people on the street in Bamenda, the largest city in that part of the country. That's what the army has been saying. That's why they opened fire and killed three separatist militants. So what we can draw from that is that the election may not, we don't know, but it, in this kind of situation, it may not help unless there is later on a sort of dialogue as with the new power in place and the election behind. Maybe that will be conducive to a better dialogue in the country. But right now, the area is very militarized and there are tensions everywhere in that part of the country.
That was our colleague Bakasi Kora speaking from Cameroon with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson.
The World Health Organization and officials in Democratic Republic of Congo report a jump in the number of Ebola cases in the past few days. There are at least 177 confirmed or probable cases in eastern DRC as of Saturday. That's up from 162 last Tuesday. There are 11 suspected cases being tested. At least 113 people have died in this outbreak, the first in the eastern DRC. Some of the recent deaths have been outside hospitals, which increases the risk of spreading the disease. Many communities have burial traditions in which mourners touch the bodies of loved ones, exposing them to the virus. Efforts to contain the outbreak have struggled because of the security threats caused by several militant groups, community mistrust of medical practitioners, and the geographic spread of the virus. The WHO is concerned the virus could spread into neighboring countries.
World leaders have pledged to make new commitments to fight tuberculosis. A United Nations high-level meeting on TB took place last month in New York, where it was revealed TB remains the world's deadliest drug-resistant infection. More than 500,000 new cases of drug-resistant TB occurred in 2017. Phil O'Brock, senior vice president of the TB Alliance and a participant at the meeting, says world leaders must make funding for new research and new drugs a priority to end this ancient disease. He spoke with me about why TB continues to kill so many people.
I think TB is at a very interesting crossroads at the moment. The situation is still very bleak. It's the biggest infectious disease killer in the world. There are over 10 million people a year infected by TB and developing active disease, and almost 1.6 million people dying. That, in a sense, is a very bleak scenario, and it has been like this for ages. What I think is the interesting part at the moment, and this is recognized through the high-level event with heads of state last week in New York, is that there's hope. There are developments that make us think that we can actually control TB and ultimately get to the situation where we can end it.
Why is it that TB is so prevalent today?
There's a number of important reasons. First of all, it has always been a very complex disease that is very hard to control and very hard to treat. It takes many months, even for the most simple basic drug-sensitive TB, to be treated. On top of that, TB hits the poorest of the poor generally. People that are outside of the purview of many health systems, people that will find it hard to seek health care. This has been aggravated by the HIV epidemic. That is a strong and important co-epidemic. TB hits people with diabetes more, so there's an important co-infection with diseases like diabetes that are growing.
I understand that the TB treatment that is going on today is about 55% effective. So if you could explain why that is, and then what types of new treatments were you all talking about putting into place at the UNGA in New York?
Well, first of all, it's important to realize that if you have regular, what we call drug-sensitive TB, the cure rates are a lot higher than that. They're probably closer to 90% globally. What is particularly concerning, and that has everyone talking, is, of course, drug-resistant TB. Over the last decade, there have been a growing number of people that have become resistant to the current treatment for regular TB. And for those people that have drug-resistant TB, which is sort of split into multi-drug-resistant TB, which has a 55% cure rate globally, according to the WHO, and extensively drug-resistant TB that only has a 30% cure rate globally, that's the real area where we see the concern. For people with regular TB, there is a 6 months time frame for treatment, and if you have drug-resistant TB, that starts getting from 9 to 12 months or even up to 2 or 3 years. The discussions that happened at the UN high-level meeting were twofold. First of all, how do we invest in such a way that we can really speed up the development of new treatments, new vaccines, and new diagnostics for TB? And then how can we, as quickly as possible, implement those and make sure that they get adopted and available to everyone who needs it? There's a big underinvestment that has taken place in TB because there's no money to be made by the private sector in treating TB, and that's why the pharmaceutical industry has largely withdrawn. Outside of that, governments therefore have to basically realize that there is an investment need, and this needs to be shared as a burden across the world. So an important discussion last week in New York was how globally governments, including governments, for instance, in Africa and Asia, can come together to invest in these new treatments and vaccines that are available in the pipeline and could be brought to patients in the next 5 to 10 years.
So then looking ahead and from this meeting, do you feel that world leaders are going to place this as a high priority?
That's a good question, which we will have to make sure they are kept accountable for. If you look at the Heads of State Declaration that was signed last week, and if you look at the statements on the floor, I believe there was a strong commitment to do exactly that, to put the attention for TB on the agenda of the Head of State and to ensure that this larger commitment, larger funding, a larger practical care for TB patients would be on the agenda of heads of state. It is somewhat disappointing if you look at only 16 heads of state ultimately decided to come and make statements on the floor. And the other part of that is that the commitments are really very global. It's a strong declaration. They're very strong targets, but they're phrased as global targets. And as you can imagine, no country individual will take on the responsibility for a global target. So the question is really for each country, how much am I going to be able to commit, and I'm willing to take leadership to do my portion of what needs to be done to eradicate TB.
That was Ville Brock, Senior Vice President of the TB Alliance. He spoke with me from New York.
Over the weekend, VOA South Sudanian Focus team broke the news of an 8-hour-long standoff between prisoners and South Sudan security officials in Juba. The Blue House prison uprising ended peacefully Sunday. Prisoners now are asking the International Committee of the Red Cross to step in and lead negotiations between them and the government. VOA's Ian Bior brings us an update on the story.
South Sudan in Focus obtained audio from a source that does not want to be identified for fear of reprisal. In the clip, you can hear Kerbina Wool, who has been in prison since late April, request access to a lawyer.
Request an access to our family and to our lawyers. That's what we request. We also request to be detained back, all of us together.
We apologize for the poor quality of the audio. But in it, you can hear Wool say they were assured the prisoners would be detained together in the same prison, but they do not know the validity of that assurance. He says they are vulnerable, and they requested help from the ICRC, adding their phones may be taken away, and it could be hard to reach them. Wool also mentions a meeting with Mr. Ayor, and says he and Peter Biar Ajok and Abraham Ajok will go to that meeting. On Sunday morning local time, Wool said about 200 armed prisoners were protesting long jail times without access to lawyers. They were demanding due process and asked the president to keep his promise and release all political prisoners. Presidential spokesman Atenwa Katen categorically denied Wool's accusations.
That's a complete lie. Even the facility itself is very small. It cannot even carry, practically cannot even carry more than 200 or 150. Cannot take it. The facility is very small. And this place has been used as a transit point for the criminals who are actually answering cases of the crime they committed. And most of them are soldiers who do not actually necessarily fall within the category of what you call the political detainees.
Last month, President Salva Kiir ordered the release of all prisoners of war and detainees in accordance with the revitalized peace agreement. Wohl and other prisoners interviewed downplayed the significance of that announcement, saying the president has made such pronouncements before. One prisoner called the decree false. Ayan Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
Twenty minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The past months have seen a resurgence of violence in Mali, which has long suffered from instability despite international efforts to bring peace. In the past few weeks alone, there have been reports of suspected extremist attacks on the Mali military, ethnic violence among civilian communities, and conflicts over scarce resources. The causes are many and complicated, and they cross borders. Corinne Difka is the West Africa Director for Human Rights Watch and closely monitors the developments in Mali. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about the latest attacks and what can be done to help prevent them.
Well, indeed, the security situation and the situation with respect to protecting human rights has been deteriorating in 2018. There have been numerous clashes in which, in total, hundreds of civilians have been killed this year within the context of intercommunal violence, but underscored by a fight against armed Islamists in the region. Mali is a huge country. It's twice the size of Texas. Their army is challenged at the best of times to respond to all of the myriad security challenges. And so ethnically allied self-defense groups have stepped into to if not complement, at least try to protect their communities within this context. And along the Niger border and the Burkina Faso border, you have a number of these ethnically allied self-defense groups who have been engaging in operations against who they believe are armed Islamists. And again, there have been many, many civilians killed in the context of this dynamic. There are a number of issues which have conspired to make the situation so precarious this year in Mali. Number one is the limited progress on the 2015 peace accord, which was to have led to disarmament of armed groups. Also, you have arms proliferation. In addition, you have, as I mentioned, the lack of state presence in so many of these areas.
What can be done to improve this situation?
Well, clearly the Malian security forces have to step up to the plate and do more to ensure proactive patrolling to be able to protect civilians. And as well, the United Nations have to do that. There is a very large peacekeeping force in Mali, which has also suffered numerous losses. They have been targeted on many, many occasions by the armed groups. And, you know, there are more peacekeepers who have been killed in Mali than in any other mission, which makes patrolling difficult. On top of that, you have, because of rapid population growth, global warming, as well as the lack of proper management of resources, you have a lot of competition over land and water between agriculturalists and pastoralists.
What is the role of Mali's military in all of this?
Well, the Malian military has been very challenged to ensure security and the protection of civilians through not only its vast northern regions, but also increasingly in the center. But also there have been grave problems with very serious abuses committed by the Malian military in the context of counterterrorism operations. You know, we always tell them that it's important to respect human rights for principled reasons, because, of course, it is wrong to engage in extrajudicial executions and disappearances and so on, but also for practical reasons, because the armed Islamist groups use the abuses by the Malian security forces as a recruitment tool.
What is at the core of all these problems?
Well, Mali has suffered from political instability and armed conflict for decades. You know, this is a country that has had several coup d'etats and four armed conflicts, usually separatist in nature. But at the core of that, there, and this is, you know, these issues the international community should pay more attention to, and that is issues of governance and corruption. Because I spend quite a lot of time speaking with villagers from all over, and they repeatedly state grievances at the Malian state for corruption, for bad governance, and lack of development. So Mali needs to take these issues seriously, as does the international community, and address some of these issues which really are at the core of its instability and cycles of violence.
That was Human Rights Watch's Corinne Difka speaking with our colleague Kate Pound Dawson.
Italy has said it will not allow planes carrying migrants from European Union member states to land in the country. The new Italian government has made clear the EU needs to share the burden of migrants. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Interior Minister Matteo Salvini has made clear Italy will be no landing ground for asylum seekers. In the same way that ports have been closed to boats with migrants, Italy will close its airports to unauthorized planes carrying them. In a statement, Salvini said, "If someone in Berlin or Brussels thinks of dumping dozens of immigrants in Italy via unauthorized charter flights, they should know that there is not and there will be no airport available." Labour Minister Luigi Di Maio, who is Deputy Prime Minister along with Salvini, was quick to voice his agreement.
Io questa cosa dei charter con I migranti che arrivano in Italia non so chi l'abbia autorizzato.
Di Maio said he did not know who authorized these charters because on the matter of secondary movements, which has been the subject of Italy's talks with the European Union that were requested by Germany, no agreement has been signed. Di Maio added such an agreement is required before any such charter flights can take place. Italy and Germany have been working on a deal under which Germany would send back to Italy migrants who have already applied for asylum in Italy, but the accord has yet to be signed. Following the comments by the two Italian ministers, the spokesman for Germany's Interior Ministry, Sören Schmidt, declared that no planes have been scheduled to bring migrants to Italy and there are no concerns over collaboration with Rome. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's spokeswoman, Martina Fitz, said an agreement has been reached and Germany hopes it will soon be signed, just like similar accords between Spain and Greece. According to EU regulations, asylum seekers are normally required to apply for asylum in the first EU country where they set foot, and that is often Italy because of its proximity to the African coast. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Aiden Utko, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African music mix on The Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African music mix plays only the best.
Yes, sir. Two-Face. NATO C. Hey. tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.